Is everybody comfortable enough? You have enough blankets and things, you're warm enough? Maybe taking a few moments to just remind yourself of the main points of impermanence, the definition. Just bring it to mind again. That which is momentary. Just remind yourself, what does that mean? Momentary in the physical condition. The physical continuum, momentary in time. All conditioned things, things that are brought about through causes and conditions, all of them. There is not one moment that abides the same way as the next without change. Even more subtly, from the beginning of the moment, there is no time to the end of that moment. That there is no change. Change is constant. We think we understand impermanence because we see things collapsing around us, we see people dying. And it seems to us that generally it seems to be the external causes here that cause this. And while, of course, this has influence, the Dharma understanding, the true understanding, the subtle understanding of impermanence is that things change by their very nature. This is what they do. All conditioned things by their very nature change, alter, always fluctuating. In the meditation we did, we looked at ourselves. Every part of our body, every part of our mind, there was nothing permanent there. Everything was in motion. And when it was spread into this room, things that appear so permanent or have some sort of permanence within it, not true. And then we expand it to the land of joy, to England, to the country, to the world. Nothing. Yet that's not how we behave. That's not how we see it, and it's not how we behave. Even if we have a high intellectual understanding of impermanence, even physicists who deal with this momentary change, this whizzing about of particles, even although they see everything as like that, that's not how we behave. We're completely mad. We know things are impermanent, but we do not behave as if they are. And we wonder why we suffer. But the good news is, because things are impermanent, we can't change. Nothing is static. So we have the ability to change our lives, to change our minds, to learn and develop. You couldn't do all these things if things were as you think they are, permanent. You couldn't do any of that if, as you think they are, there is some permanence within it. Couldn't do it. How could you do it? It's only because it's permanent. Now here, remember, I'm not saying impermanence bad, permanence good, or impermanence good, permanence bad. I'm not saying that. That's not the judgment we're making. What we're looking at is the nature of phenomena, how things actually exist. And when we get that clear in our mind, then we try to then alter our behaviour in line with reality. That's all this is, in line with reality, instead of how we always live our lives, which is in line with nonsense. But it's a big shift, isn't it? It's a huge shift. So that's revived what we did so far this morning. So now we do another meditation on the same lines. Remembering to use the analysis, the analytical way of dealing with it, coming to some form of conclusion and then focusing. And when you lose that focus, refocus. Okay? Because we're not just moving our mind. Oh yes, this is what I thought impermanence was. So analysis is, ooh, this is what the Dhamma says it is. So you've moved up the analysis. Now, focus. And that will change the mind, help to change the mind towards seeing things in reality. So always remember this analytical and single point, very important. Okay. So using the two-breath method, again, or anything that helps deeply relax the body quickly. Drawing the mind inward. So again, that we remind ourselves, all conditioned phenomena, without exception, constantly affected by the force of change from within. There is no need of a secondary outside force for this to occur. All conditioned phenomena have no conceivable moment, part of a moment, to be the same, unaffected by change. This is the real meaning of impermanence. Try to focus. With this understanding that objects are impermanent by their own nature, they cease to exist in an instant from the preceding moment. This is beyond any control. Consider how this could lead to freedom from attachment and freedom from aversion. So not just freedom from attachment, but also freedom from aversion. Consider. If it helps to bring about a profound experience of freedom from this kind of fixation, clinging, grasping, attachment, feel how that would affect our lives. Feel the relaxation that would come with that. Relaxation within this free, natural flow of reality. Try to generate a sense of appreciation free from attachment, quite joyful in its nature. And when that's as strong as you can make it, focus. Now choose an object that you have, that you're very fond of, perhaps an object you come into contact with every day, or a new object that you've just been waiting for. Choose that object, bring it to mind. Observe it from all angles. Try to see its nature. Really turn it over, view from all angles, gaze, touch, smell it even with your mind. Try to see its nature. despite my intellectual knowledge of impermanence? Does there seem to be something permanent about it? Not intellectually now, but just as you gaze at that object, does there seem to be something coming from its own side that seems to be permanent? Or have something permanent within it? We're born seeing things this way. And this permanence is a hallucination, a frozen image, a still image, a snapshot in time. And we take this frozen snapshot in time and imbue it with permanence, without control. It's a permanent hallucination. We exaggerate its nature, impose permanence on it, then grasp at it and cherish it as reality. See if that's true. Again, refocus on this image, this object. Mentally gaze at it. Just unfreeze that image. See the flow of its true nature, ever changing. See it for what it is. Seeing its true nature, what is there to grasp at? And once more, immerse yourself in the awareness of the different parts of your own body, this object, its shape, its size, its texture, its temperature, the movement of the breath, deeper, deeper to cellular and molecular levels. See once more the flow, the ever-changing ebb and tide. begin once more to expand your awareness as far as you can, immersing yourself in the ever-fluctuating nature of how things actually are. Reflect again that all I experience with my senses exist in this way. All that I experience with my senses exist in this way. Relaxing your focus, just take a minute or two to stretch, move around till you're a wee bit comfortable before we go into the next meditation. this is just a brief meditation. You're not in for the long haul, no worries. Trying to tie this together in some way. So drawing the mind inward. Deeply relaxing the body on the out-breath. You keep relaxing the body on the out-breath till you're at a state with your body that you're content with. Then keeping that relaxation, allow your mind to brighten with each in-breath. Just notice that as you breathe normally on each in-breath now, the mind is becoming brighter. With each in-breath, your mind becoming sharper. So with impermanence, like every aspect of the Lam Rim, it's a journey towards subtle wisdom, away from gross ignorance. Consider a journey towards subtle wisdom, away from gross ignorance. On this journey, each step reduces the disparity between how things are, our intellectual understanding of the world, and how we behave within the world. It reduces the disparity. Can we see how that could be? On this path to wisdom, the companion of choice that keeps us straight, our best buddy, is impermanence. Consider how that can be true. On the road to wisdom, the companion of choice that keeps us straight, impermanence. And when that statement starts ringing true in your mind, and you can start to taste that focus. Thank you. There will be an exam at the end of this course. Yeah. Okay, good. So, now in pairs. I'm going to give you 20 minutes. What I'd like you to do is discuss anything that came to mind this morning about permanence and impermanence, particularly impermanence. But I'd like your main focus to be, why is our intellectual understanding of impermanence so at odds with our behaviour? Don't just give yourself one or two word answers. Try to give yourself some, bring some experience to mind where our intellectual understanding was so at odds with how we behaved. So at odds. So anything that came up this morning is useful. But the main focus, why is our intellectual understanding of impermanence at odds with how we behave in this world? And try to give each other examples of how this seems to be the case. Really what we're trying to do here is make it real. So good discussion? Yeah. Good. Okay. Right. So this is the first discussion you've had this morning. The only one. And there was a lot to discuss. So what would you like to say about your discussion? What type of things came up? I was interested in, as you remember, why our intellectual understanding is so at odds with how we behave in the world and with examples, but also anything else that came up. We could start with the chart.
Sorry.
Don't think I didn't notice. We're all having a good wee chat here, that's excellent. Yes. Apart from getting to know each other. Anything come up?
Lots of things.
Yeah, too much to say, really.
Yeah, I kind of go through it all in my head, then I come to abbreviated things, you know.
Uh-huh.
Because it's simpler. But I feel, I'm talking from my own observation of my own life, and also being a therapist, how I've used some, how other clients sometimes work with things.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that it's habitual. And it's a pattern.
Uh-huh.
And I believe there's a big part of people who are scared, there's a fear of stepping outside of what they perhaps really do know in their subconscious or their true nature. It's like, who's going to change first?
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to move away from saying how they feel instead of keeping the cycle going? And that's because people want to be accepted and they want to be loved and they want all of those attachments, all of those senses or things, that when they start to step out of that and see what it's really about, it becomes really scary for
you. It can. Yes.
So it's a habit and a pattern.
Okay. Now put it in the first person, yourself, if you can.
What do I feel?
Do you feel, yeah. Is it very similar or something different or...?
Well, it's similar but different. What I was saying to Mary was I feel with the toxic environment I came up in my childhood and through my life and going through a lot of suffering, I learnt the impermanence of life and of people quite uh-huh. quickly. But my neediness for love and to be seen overruled everything mentally. Yeah. So the physical attachment to things wasn't really my thing, it was more of a mental process.
Understand.
So when I look back, I can see that everything's been leading to this.
Okay.
But my habit of self-flagellation or beating myself up stopped me from doing that.
Okay.
Because in the meditation this morning, it makes complete sense.
Excellent, good.
Complete sense.
Yeah. Well, this is what it's about. Doing these types of meditation is fine, but it's better to get, you know, once you understand a wee bit of the intellectual bit, you know, really turning it inwards to yourself and seeing how have I been behaving? What type of circumstances have I been in? And if you can marry these two up, I mean, it's perfect. Thank you. Anything else?
We got into quite a good conversation about the eight worldly dharmas, didn't we? Yeah. Just a few pages back, we were thinking that's why. Because we like all the, you know, the nice praise and all the, you know, the material things, and we're in the quicksand really. Although we can kind of see that it makes sense that things don't last forever, but actually, in our day-to-day lives, it's quite hard, isn't it?
Yeah.
To kind of, especially when people have such busy lives and commitments, and you kind of really get sucked into the quicksand.
I think you need to think about why it's hard, why it is difficult. I think that's important, and habits certainly, but not just from this lifetime. Many, many, many lifetimes. And it comes with innate ignorance. This is, again, you want to be thinking about ignorance, you know, this misknowing reality, this misknowing of reality, how things are. And in the Dharma, they talk about two types of ignorance. They talk about innate ignorance and learnt ignorance. And innate ignorance really is the ignorance you're born with. We're programmed. We're hotwired. The moment we leave the womb is to see things with this hallucination, this concept of solidity, permanence. You know, and if we don't see the permanence, we want to impose permanence. We're hotwired. And because we're hotwired, this is not easy to deal with. It really isn't easy to deal with. What works for us on our own side is that even the little bit I've done here, but I mean, there's really excellent books on this. I mean, you get very, very clear, really clear on this. If you, it's not that difficult to get an intellectual understanding. It's not that difficult to move away from the understanding that we had on impermanence to the understanding that is more in tune with reality. That type of intellectual understanding, I think it doesn't take so much, really. You know, you just average intelligence and a wee bit of work, that can be done. So that's on our side, right? Opposing that is this innate ignorance that is not saying to, you're not going, right, I'm going, now I think I'll just see these things as permanent. There's no choice here, very little choice. You're born with this innate ignorance. So you have to use this intellectual understanding. You have to start altering the mind, which is where this innate ignorance is. And then slowly that will begin to alter. But it is extremely... You can't come away thinking, well, because I know it, I can now do it. No, from the moment you wake up, all your senses are firing on ignorance. All of them are firing on ignorance. So the first thing you do with all your senses firing on ignorance is you calm those five senses down. Take them offline. Take them offline by deep relaxation. Allow mental consciousness. Now you just have to deal with the ignorance of the mental consciousness. Much better than the other five as well. Put them to sleep. Switch them off. And this is where your analysis, using your intellectual understanding and your ability to focus to change the mind. This is not easy. This is a work in progress all the way through to liberation. All the way through. And seemingly it happens, you know, slowly, easily. A bit like emptiness. That you get the intellectual understanding. If you put the work in and the effort and the meditation, you start to get it in meditation. You start to, within your meditation, you start to see things more clearly. You start to have that innate ability to utilize this properly. And then when you come out, more difficult, but still you're managing something. Back in meditation, more energy coming out more and more, you're able to do outside of meditation. What you're learning in meditation, you're able to practice, until there comes a time, whether you're in or out of meditation, that's how you see the world. So, yes, it's habit, but this, that's not something to beat yourself up. Oh, I'm just so stupid. No. We're all like that, every one of us. Unless you're all, as it's quite possible, all just here to help me get enlightened. You're all bodhisattvas already. All of us are in the same boat. But learning to calm down these other five senses and just leaving yourself one to work with.
You know, the strange thing about it is that I have all the tools to do that, and I've procrastinated and sat and not done it.
Yes.
It's ridiculous.
But welcome to the club. I mean, we're all paid, fully paid up members. This is not, I understand, but you see, we use that type of thing to beat ourselves up and put ourselves down, and depression, low self-esteem. But when you look around, most of us in the same boat.
Yeah.
Most of us. We need to nurture this intellectual understanding. Is so important to get that right. And then we need to nurture it in meditation to give yourself the energy. And then we need to apply it outside of meditation. Yes. Give it a go. It's worth it, isn't it? It's worth it. Okay, what else came out of your discussions?
We had a mixture of things. We talked about one of the reasons why is our ego is very much against impermanence, because it sees itself as totally permanent and will fight tooth and nail to maintain that. So
that's right.
Even though you have the intellectual understanding, you have this constant saying, no.
Yeah. So self-cherishing.
Yeah.
Self-cherishing is the root of everything. All suffering. Self-cherishing. And you're right, it'll do anything to avoid anything that even smacks of impermanence. But what's wrong with that? What do you think?
Well, it restricts the mind, you know, how it It's not open at all.
No. It's got a stranglehold. It's a complete stranglehold. The self-cherishing. But the good news here is you can attack self-cherishing in a number of ways. You don't just have to attack it on impermanence. There's many ways of attacking self-cherishing. The idea is to recognise the self-cherishing. Where does it come from? How does it grow? How does it maintain itself? Not just through impermanence, through many things. But you're right, it stops it. Self-cherishing. Root of all problems, really. Get rid of that, you're fine. Really. You're fine. What else came up?
Stability. Wishing for stability and security. And I link back to laziness. Just as human beings, we do tend to be lazy. If we can have little structures that make things we don't have to put too much effort in, then we tend to say thank you.
And in relation to impermanence?
Well, that was linked into, like, although there may only be a small element of permanence that we put into everything, it does imply a sort of stability that we can rely on, although it's not there,
yes.
But we can rely on it.
Okay.
And that then reduces our fear of losing things.
Yes. And where does the fear come from? I mean, you're right. It's absolutely, I mean, it sounds perfect to me. Where does the fear come from? Everything is interdependent. Nothing arises. Nothing arises in and of itself. It's interdependent. So something must have given rise to that fear. What gave rise to the fear, do you think? I mean, generally, what gives rise? In this situation, what gives rise to that fear?
Self-cherishing.
Yes. It is the self-cherishing that's doing this. It's one of its defence mechanisms. It's interesting because I sometimes talk about self-cherishing as if it's an independent entity that's floating around somewhere within me, you know, that I'm trying to catch. You know, it's a bit of a shock when you find it doesn't actually exist, but we behave as if it does. It's self-cherishing that's doing this. This fear. Excellent, thank you. What else? What else came up? The finger's going to be pointed. I mean, I was hoping to get through a morning without doing this, okay?
Well, I'm going to steal this from Wendy.
All right.
We were talking about using... Given that our attitude, the way we view things as permanent, actually, I'm not defending it, but it has a social function. It oils the wheels, as it were. It also screws them up, but at one level it oils the wheels. And we were talking
Something we can all be confused with. Okay.
And we were talking about triggers to bring it home. So when you wake up in the morning, what you actually need is somebody to smack you over the head in the morning and say, it's impermanent. But you could triggers that you can use to do that. And there's the classic about the chocolate that turns to caca. But I like Wendy's suggestion that we are very fortunate, don't often hear this, very fortunate to live in the climate we do because it is so changeable.
Absolutely.
And you can actually use that as a trigger to remind yourself.
It's true. It's interesting because there's lots of different types of triggers. What other type of triggers? I mean, that works. That really works. I think we're very fortunate in this climate, definitely. What other triggers could we use to remind ourselves of impermanence, do you think?
It sounds a bit gross, but I do use going to the toilet.
Yes, it is.
Oh, wow, yeah, I really enjoyed that breakfast, and now it's down the middle.
Yes, yes.
It's gross, but...
Yeah. I'm a bit similar in the shower.
Yes, exactly.
A bit similar in the shower.
A shower, it's so clean, and then you know
it's, you know, very shortly you'll feel differently.
What else could you use as a trigger?
Eventually you'll use aches and pains.
Aches and pains? Okay, what else?
You can actually use the breath.
You can use the breath, what else? Okay, I'll ask you another question. What would not remind you of impermanence? Think of a whole day. What would not remind you of impermanence? It's a trick question. There is nothing. And so you choose the trigger that's useful to you. You choose the trigger that's useful to you. If you study the Lam Rim, which I hope we've got enough time to look at, a good ways to, if you are interested in studying the Lam Rim, how to go about it, you know, on an easy level, a medium level, and going for it level, you know what I mean? That type of thing. But there's, if you study the Lam Rim and you set your motivation in the morning towards one particular aspect, let's say precious human rebirth, and today, and you, part of your motivation is today, I will notice my precious human rebirth at least 6 times. At least 6 times today, I'm going to notice this. Then I get my iPhone out and I program my iPhone to ring at certain times. And when that rings, and it's got a different ringtone, when that rings, I stop whatever I'm doing, as long as I'm not driving, eh? And I look around me and think, where does my precious human rebirth fit in here? Now, you can do that with anything. That includes emptiness, that looks including permanence, impermanence. I find that very useful. It's not so important when I'm on actually doing retreat, because once you set your motivation up and you're doing your practices, it's actually quite difficult for your mind to go all over the place. You've kind of got a lot to do, eh? So you know. But when I'm not, and I choose one aspect of the Lam Rim that today or for this week I'm going to focus on, then I personally use my mobile phone. It's a trigger that, and I stop and I just take a minute or two to think, what is going on here? How does this all relate to impermanence? It can only take a minute or two, but it's worth it. It's worth it. I find it. I like technology. I mean, I do. I like my technology. Touch my iPad at your peril. That's all I'm saying. So, there's lots of different ways. I mean, really, there's lots of different ways. I wanted to remember a particular deity practice I was practicing. And I was able to get a mantra of that deity, which I wear around my wrist. Okay? Now, having said that, this is about the third one that I've not yet given away. People say, well, that's really nice. But anyway... And that was a really good trigger for me, because whatever I'm doing, I'm kind of, oh yeah, you know. I use a lot of physical stuff to help me. But once the physicality fits in, then I take it to my mind. So trigger is extremely important.
Yeah. I use my two young daughters fight all the time. I've started using, when they start fighting, for me to start reciting mantras.
Yes!
It's great. Yes. As soon as they start, I just start doing the mantras.
Oh Lord, right. You can get them on CD, you know. Yeah. Play them loud and play them proud. What else came up in your discussion? Especially this dichotomy. Anybody have a situation where they understood the intellectual aspect of it but behaved completely the opposite? You don't have to share everything, just... Because see, that disparity is what we're working towards, doing this. Reducing and eliminating that disparity. You know, once you know how things are, why would you put any effort into hallucinating something else? Well, habit is true. Comfort, that the familiar. Everybody else is doing it. Another plus. All this nonsense. I mean, I know people use The Matrix a lot. It's been many years since I've seen The Matrix. I must watch it again. But if anybody's ever seen that film, there's one man there who's acting as a double agent. And all he wants to do is to go back into The Matrix. He wants to go back, be plugged in, to have his hallucinatory life. He was unplugged, saw reality and thought, oh, no thanks, and wants to go back in. Right? And sometimes it's almost like that.
Mm.
I'd rather have that which is familiar, that everybody agrees with me is right.
Yeah.
You to walk the path that mind is not. There's many people walk the path, but each person is walking their own path. And that can be a bit scary. Yeah. Anything else?
Yeah, we actually use the matrix to show how everything is impermanent.
But you can do that with most things.
Because there's one scene where the main characters actually start seeing everything as it really is, which is just computer code.
Yeah, yeah.
So everything was just computer code moving, people.
And once they knew that, what could they do?
Yes.
What could they not do? And when you read the stories of various tantric practitioners who have refined their mind to such a extent, and they can do these wondrous things, you know, you think, oh my Lord, you know, put footprints in solid ground, being able to, you know, fly, you know, you sort of go, but able to do all these other things, what you have to really think about is how could that not be possible if you refined your mind to that extent? If you don't believe and invest in everything that your senses tell you, actually, it's amazing what can be done. And certainly, when you develop shamatha to a very high extent, naturally, without trying, certain qualities come. Qualities of clairvoyance, qualities of clairaudience, far-seeing, fast-walking, all these things that we read now of people, oh, that was in bygone times, you know, in days of yore. But actually, once the mind is free, and in its pristine you've accessed that pristine condition, these qualities come. And that's one of the reasons that Shantideva said practice shamatha, because if you truly want to help people, you need clairvoyance. Whatever you do without clairvoyance will always 50-50 chance of being useful. With clairvoyance, much higher. But he wasn't saying study clairvoyance. He wasn't saying put effort into clairvoyance. He said practice shamatha. Then these things come. Yes, good. Anything else? Nothing else?
I'm suddenly reminded of that spoof appraisal that says, and I think I certainly do this, and I suspect we all do it to some degree, sets himself low standards and which he consistently fails to achieve. We say to ourselves, no, I can't do that,
yeah.
So I'm not even going to try.
No, no. And people pat you on the back and say, that's reasonable, that's logical. A lot of that is because we believe things. Don't believe anything, really. Investigate everything. Treat everything with a wee bit of scepticism. Everything. Because things are not as they appear to you. It's not that they don't exist. Of course they exist. But not the way you think. So approach everything with just that wee bit of scepticism. Happy, cheerful, joyful, loving, compassionate. None of that goes. But you don't have to believe in it. Just be a wee bit sceptical of situations, people. When you're sceptical of people, you know, I'm not saying, don't trust that, but I'm not meaning that. I mean, this is not as it appears. This person is not as it appears to me. Not at all. I go for a walk in the woods, you know. Oh, the beautiful trees and the squirrels, you know. We're believing 100% in all this, eh? No. Be a wee bit sceptical. You're a wee bit sceptical, your belief kind of goes down a bit, and that's always helpful. If you've got less belief, you've got room for wisdom. Yeah, don't need the belief with the wisdom. Okay, so we'll do a last short meditation on this. So settling the body, deep relaxation. Breathing evenly and gently. And we consider, what's the way forward? How do I increase my intellectual understanding of impermanence? Are there any pointers that will help me? Well, anything that does not have a conceivable time duration where it abides without change is impermanent. Anything that has a time duration to abide without change is permanent. Those are good pointers. Another pointer could be, all functioning phenomena, all phenomena that functions, is impermanent. All types of forms that are functioning, all type of consciousnesses that are functioning, non-associated phenomena such as a year, a person, a country, all of these are impermanent. All non-functioning phenomena, all non-functioning phenomena that do not arise from causes and conditions and don't change from moment to moment are permanent. Examples of this? Well, unproduced empty space, sometimes called non-compounded space. Now, this is not compounded space that's full of quasars and event horizons and busy. No, they're impermanent. This is unproduced empty space. J. genetic images. Are permanent. They're non-functioning. True cessation of suffering is permanent. Emptiness is a permanent phenomenon. And you can say that the absence of the elephant in the room is a permanent phenomenon. But here's the key with permanence. Permanent phenomena can only be viewed with the mind. Permanent phenomena cannot be viewed through physical senses. You cannot see unproduced empty space. You conclude it's there by looking through it. These are excellent pointers to investigate further. A conceptual mind, and this is what we all have, a conceptual mind only knows its object through generic images. It does not view the objects directly. This is why they're untrue. A conceptual mind never sees the object directly. So these are the pointers to, as you start to study, that will help you navigate your way through what is permanent and what is impermanent. The functioning aspect is very useful. As is the fact that permanent phenomena can only be known through mind, never through the senses. Is there any of these points which stick in your mind more than others? If so, cultivate it. And conclude by coming to a strong determination. I will accept and expect the impermanent nature of all things. I will use this knowledge to enhance my life and the life of others. Thank you.
Can you tell me what a generic images.
Mm. Okay. If you think of, if I say to you, see what comes up in your mind, holiday, what comes up in your mind?
Beach.
It's a generic image. It's a generic image.
That's a thing, though.
Is it?
Is this a bit like Plato's World of Ideas?
If you think, the dodo doesn't exist, does it? The dodo.
No.
It's an extinct bird, right? Flightless bird, right? Mm-hmm. But if I said to you dodo, an image will come to your mind.
Yeah.
Doesn't exist, does it? Yeah. The dodo. Oh, so what you've got is a generic image. And it's not, you need, it needs to be studied. You need to look at the difference between conceptual minds and direct perception. This is a, these are things. Remember, I said to you with mind, there's a psychological approach, and there's an epistemological approach. And this comes under more the epistemological approach. And there's language code that goes with that, certain ways of thinking, certain definitions that you need to kind of study up on. But one of the ways you can access is really look at the difference between what is a conceptual mind and what is direct perception. And what is the journey from here to here? That's quite useful. But what you can say is the mind we're using now is a conceptual mind. And so we don't see objects as they are. We don't see them, what the wording, the language code is, we don't see the object directly. We see it through generic imaging. So it's worth it. It's absolutely worth it. So instead of going on to death, we might do that, start that after lunch. I was going to see people individually, but I thought maybe it might be better talking just as a group. Walking meditations. So you've got walking meditations and meditating while walking. So meditating while walking really is just going for a walk, but keeping your mind on a meditative topic. Hopefully with your eyes open so you don't fall over, right? Walking meditation is bringing your awareness to what you're doing. And it could be to any part of the body. Generally, you stand and you make your motivation for this walk, whatever your motivation is going to be. And you bring your consciousness down into the feet. This is one way of doing it, into the feet. And then basically, from a standing point, you start to move. Move too slowly, you'll fall over, okay? But people tend to go slowly to start with. And as you bring your consciousness down, now what helps to bring the consciousness down is what we've been doing in class, on the out-breath. Yes? And remember I said, feel the tingling sensation in your feet. So instead of feeling that and then coming up through the body, keep it there. Keep it there. Now, interesting, it's good. The mind and body contact goes very closely together. The mind will always follow contact, okay? So if you bring your mind down to your feet, all you're being asked to do really is to walk forward. And what you're doing is your mind is completely with what you're doing with your feet. So you feel the heel, the instep, the toe, the same time you're feeling the foot lifting and moving, right? It's good to have your eyes in front, slightly down, and what's called a soft gaze. So you're not looking at the ground, you're kind of looking, about here, kind of a soft gaze. So you're not going to step on anybody, and you're moving forward, but you're always with the movement of the feet, the pressure on each part of the feet, and moving that way. And literally that's what you do. It's very good to set out a path first. Sometimes it's advised to have something like 20 or 30 steps, have a bear and back. Now, I tend to do it simply like that because it helps with my shamatha. That I like it like that. But when I stop at the end of the path, then what I'm doing really is, my mind is here, but I'm trying to catch the urge to move, that impetus to move. Instead of just going, You know, that before any movement, there is an urge to move. So I'm trying to catch that really. And then moving. And then knowing, just being aware. And that's why the soft gaze is nice, that I'm in the middle of the beginning of the path, the middle of the path, the end of the path. And then as you get towards the end, there's an urge to stop because you've already set it out. And catching that urge is really interesting. It's really interesting. And then turning round and waiting, just waiting until that urge to move, if I can find it, because it's quite subtle, the urge to move. And that's how I do it. But there are many different ways. Many different ways. Some people hold their hands here. Some people hold their hands here. I think as long as you're relaxed, I tend to like this area very much. It feels very stable to me, very calm. So I tend to have, this is how I do it with my left hand supporting my right, thumbs together here. But that's not necessary. It's just something I find useful. But as long as you're kind of relaxed, setting your motivation beforehand, very important. Deciding what you're going to do, very important. Bring it, stand as you start, you know, just set your motivation and bring your consciousness down. Use your breath. On the out-breath, feel the tingling sensation in your feet. Feel where your feet touch the earth. Feel the weight, the distribution. And then try to keep that as you move forward. So that's one way of doing it. What about if other people here? Is there, what variations do people enjoy? Ah, come on. You all do that? Everybody does it like that? Yeah? Okay. No variations at all? Really? Okay. Okay. Just me then. All right. So that's one way. There are many ways. If you look up walking meditation, there's hundreds of different ones. But for me, they're too flowery. There's too much going on. I like to start from the point of, why am I doing it? Well, I like to be outside. That's quite handy. It's a nice day. Vitamin D is quite good. But really, it's to help with my shamatha. It's really, really to do that. It's really just helps me, you know, be where I'm meant to be. You know, putting my mind where I want to put it and keeping it there. And then when thoughts come, because they will, won't they? Ideas. If my mind gets too agitated, I keep walking, just, and but I breathe it out. Because you're keeping your mind here, but your mind will go off here and it'll go off there, right? And when it does that, then I just relax and breathe it out more deeply. Just breathe it out. I don't stop for anything. I don't apply anything complicated, just that. Breathe it out and refocus. Breathe it out and refocus. And if I find myself halfway down the path and I can't remember even getting there, you know, to the best of us, then it's a dull mind. This is a dull, sleepy mind. So I arouse my attention again and refocus, feeling the tingling sensation in my feet, lowering my consciousness, and start again. It's about doing what you set out to do. Okay, so thank you very much this morning. It's fantastic. And enjoy your lunch, remembering it's sometime before four. Decide on a half an hour. Find a place that's safe. That's safe. If you feel it's better moving a bit quicker, you know, then move a bit quicker. If you find it's easier to go slowly, go slowly. But it's good to find a safe place. Sometimes on this grass, you've got to be careful because there's holes and things in them. Okay? So plot your path. And I see you at 4 o'clock. Thank you very much. Yeah. Very kind. Please go. I'm just slow here.